Please help me welcome our speaker, Sarah from the Miracle Group in Levittown.
Hi, I'm Sarah. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sarah.
Oh, well, thank you, Mike, for asking. This is too much. I'm sorry.
You just want to hear it?
No, it's okay. It was just too close to my face. Thank you, Mike, for asking me to come out to speak tonight. I have to start out always by being completely honest and transparent. I mean, I wake up in the morning and my first instinct is to call Mike and cancel so I can be in bed at 8:30 at night. And, it's honestly been probably the hardest 2 months of my entire sobriety. And, you know, and every day I get up and I have to ask God what is needed and follow that still small voice within me and where it guides me. And tonight I got to experience something. You know, I'm really grateful not only that you asked me to come do this, but I got to, you know, get in the car with a woman who I haven't seen in a really long time. And I got to, you know, spend the drive here talking about Alcoholics Anonymous and talk about that loneliness and that isolation that, you know, that comes prior to us coming here. And not only that, but like realizing the gift that I have here in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is this fellowship, which is this connection, which is this thing that I have been seeking my entire life. You know, I spent, even before I picked up a drink, I spent so many years feeling isolated from everything, feeling separate from everything, feeling, you know, disconnected from everything. And, you know, it wasn't until I came in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and had an experience with these steps that I started to feel that connection that I was seeking. You know, the only thing that had ever given me that sense of connection was alcohol when I picked up a drink at the age of 15, you know, and I had that spiritual experience where everything in my world became okay for the first time. You know, and I came in and out of the rooms of AA for a really long time, looking for any other solution other than a spiritual one. I certainly did not want the solution to my problem to be God or the 12 steps. I thought this work was a little bit much. I certainly didn't want to, you know, make amends to people, and I didn't want to spend my time, you know, helping other people, or, you know, it was always about me. I wanted to find an easier way out. I also didn't, you know, I also thought that alcohol was the main problem. And I'm not saying that alcohol is not a problem, but coming in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for many years and getting separated from alcohol over and over and over again, I come to find out that alcohol really wasn't my problem. It was my solution. Alcohol did something for me. It changed my perception of reality. It made me okay in my own skin. It made it okay to be Sarah. And there was nothing I wouldn't have given to this power that I turned my will and my life over to at the age of 15. Like, it's so funny. I come in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and you guys tell me, you know, to turn my will and my life over to the care of this power I can't see, but I'll turn my will and my life over to the care of alcohol for 20 plus years. And alcohol was my God. It was my higher power. I gave everything to it. And I come in here and I'm thinking that's my problem. And I'm not saying alcohol's not a problem, because the second I have a drink in my body, it absolutely is. But it tells me in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that, you know, that information would be academic and pointless if I didn't pick up the drink in the first place. And so where my problem lies is in sobriety. Like, what is it that starts my mind thinking about a drink again? And for me, it's that spiritual malady. It's that spiritual sickness. It's that feeling of being isolated, alone, afraid all the time, being driven by 100 forms of fear, self-seeking, self-delusion, self-pity, like just living in that place that is so uncomfortable and so unbearable that the only thing I ever found to fix it was alcohol until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And you guys laid this spiritual kit of tools at my feet and I finally picked them up. But I'll tell you, that's just not what I was looking for. And, you know, I was always looking outside of myself to make me okay. Like, I was that alcoholic, like it talks about in the book, like under the delusion that I can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if only I manage it well. And that was the case long before I picked up a drink. I'm not saying I was an alcoholic from birth. I don't know that. I'm pretty sure I had to drink to become an alcoholic. But, you know, I certainly had all the isms well before I picked up a drink. You know, I was restless, irritable, discontent. I just didn't know what the words were. I just was so uncomfortable with everything and everyone. And I was brought up with a conception of God. My father is a retired Presbyterian minister, so everything in my childhood was about God. We prayed around food in public. We went to church every Sunday. I was in youth group, Sunday school, all this stuff. And the God they were talking about was a God that was so far away from me, a God I could not connect with, and a God I felt judged by. I heard stories like, oh, well, if you're a good little girl, you'll go to this beautiful place in the sky. And if you're a bad little girl, you're going to burn in this fiery pit. And I just never thought I was inherently good. I was a liar and a manipulator from the time I was a very little girl. I just felt bad. I never felt enough. And I just thought that this God idea coming in here was not going to work for me. I just wanted to feel a part of something. And like I said, you know, something happened to me. I experienced a trauma at the age of 15, and my mother's reaction in response to this was one of guilt and shame. Like, how could you let this happen? How could you be so stupid? Why'd you put yourself in this position? And after that happened, I'd already been living in this painful, uncomfortable skin, like walking around crippled by fear, but then this happened and it got so much worse. And then followed that is that fear, is that rage and that anger and that hatred and that wanting to just die. And I picked up a drink at age 15 and I realized the effect that alcohol could produce, and everything was okay. It didn't matter what these men did to me. It didn't matter what my mother said about it. It didn't matter what you thought of me in school. It didn't matter if I even went to school. And in the very beginning, I drank alcoholically. I had a physical allergy. I just didn't know what to call it. I just know that I drank a little differently than the other kids around me. I know I was the sloppy drunk who had to be dropped off on my parents' front doorstep. You know, I always had to be babysat, and I was blacking out from a young age. And our literature talks about this being a disease of progression. And it says many of us started out as moderate hard drinkers. And then progressed to the real alcoholic. I'm not sure I was ever a moderate drinker. I think I might have skipped right over to hard. And I don't say that because I'm a badass or anything. I say that because the book defines a moderate drinker as somebody who can stop with little trouble if given sufficient reason. And the truth is, I could never stop with little trouble. It was always painful to stop. Like at the age of 19 when I got pregnant with my daughter and, you know, I had to stop for those 9 months, not out of any sense of real virtue, like, you know, I just thought it was a bad look for a pregnant woman to sit in a bar. And I'm really like consumed with what everybody thinks of me. So I stop. And this is what separates me from a normal drinker like my sisters. You know, when they're pregnant, they're like picking up baby names. And, you know, I think it's called nesting. I don't know if any of the good mothers in the room know what it's called. I was a terrible mother, but, you know, I just wasn't doing any of that stuff. I wasn't decorating a nursery or doing any of that. I was counting the days like it was a prison sentence. Like, when can I get this kid out of me so I can get loaded again? And that's exactly what I did. And when my daughter was born, I was a terrible mother. I didn't want to wake up in the morning for her. I didn't want to do anything for her. I'm so selfish and self-centered. Having a child is an inconvenience. I drive around with her in the car loaded, and I prop her up against the wall and like, here, take a bottle so I can go back to sleep to sleep off whatever hangover I have. And, eventually, when she's 3 years old, I lose custody. And you know what I do on the outside? I do what the world wants to see. I kick and I scream and I try to run him over in the parking lot of the courthouse. I'm like, how dare you? She's my daughter. How could you take her from me? But that wasn't how I felt. Because the truth was, inside, I was relieved. I was relieved that I didn't have to wake up in the morning with my little girl anymore. I was relieved that I didn't have to be responsible for another human being anymore. I was relieved that I could do whatever I wanted to do now, and I could be the fun parent, show up when I felt like it. And very slowly, alcohol starts to dictate every part of my life. It starts to become my master, and I don't even know that's happening. You know, it's this thing about this progression that we suffer from. Like, you know, it starts out as a party and it was fun. It really was fun in the beginning. I can't lie about that. But at some point I cross over this imaginary line where it goes from being a party to being this full-time job. And then eventually it just turns into a nightmare. A nightmare I can't wake up from. And, but while I was going into that, like it's turning into a job period, I realized, you know, looking back, alcohol was dictating every decision I made, like where I lived. I moved to Manhattan because the bar stayed open until 5 a.m. I worked in the restaurant bar industry because nobody cared if I came to work loaded. And if I got fired from that job, it was really easy to get another one. And every relationship I ever had during that time was centered around alcohol and other substances. And if you didn't drink the way I drank, or if you didn't provide me with the means I needed to drink the way I wanted to drink, or, you know, if you dared to commit the fatal flaw of asking me to slow down or moderate, I just moved on to the next one. And there was always a next one, and, you know, probably more than one at a time. Because that's another thing. It's like I'm looking out here to fix what's wrong in here. That delusion. You know, I really believed for a long time that fixing up the outside was going to fix what was wrong inside. Like, if I just have the marriage, if I just have the 2.5 children and the white picket fence and all these things out here, the right job, the right dollar amount in my bank account, I'll feel okay inside. In fact, even now, at over 10 years sober, I can suffer from that exact same delusion. that the solution to my problem lies outside of me, and I end up seeking those things, and I end up actually getting some of those things. Like, again, like, I married my daughter's father, and that marriage tanked. I had all of those things, and then 7 years later, I get married again to this love of my life who I met in the bar, you know, who I went home with, and like 2 weeks later, we signed a lease together, and, you know, a month after that, he's putting a ring on me, and I'm thinking, this is the relationship. This is the marriage that's going to fix me, right? If I can just make this work, I'm going to be okay. Of course, I haven't told this man a single truth about anything. I haven't stopped drinking this entire time. And when I got pregnant 6 months later, I can't breathe a sober breath. And I don't want to. I can't stop. I don't want to stop. And I drink the entire pregnancy. And as a direct result of that, my son is born 3 months premature. And he's 2 pounds. And the first time I laid eyes on him, he's in the NICU and he's on life support. He can't breathe. He can't be held. And I look at him in that moment, and for the first time in my entire life, like the first time since I got pregnant, I felt absolute love for this little boy, at least as much love as I was capable of showing any human being at that point in my life. But what comes along with that love is this overwhelming sense of shame and guilt because I put him there. He can't breathe because of me. He can't be held because of me. And I did that. And here's the thing. I'm not a sociopath. I feel these things deeply. I feel this shame deeply. In fact, our book talks about it. It says many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them, even though we wanted to. Even though we want to. Because deep down, I want to be a good mother, and I want to be a good sister, and I want to be a good daughter. Good mother. I don't have the power to do that. The kind of mother I am, I nod out and I drop my son on the floor. I drive around with my kids intoxicated. I leave my son in the car to walk around the corner in some of the worst neighborhoods in Philadelphia. And when my son was 8 months old, I got arrested with him in the car. And I remember I got bailed out and I came home the next day. And my husband is in the living room. And he's packed up and he's ready to go and he's going to take our child and he's going to leave. And I start begging and pleading, like, please don't do this. Please, I start promising him things. And I mean these promises. I mean them with every fiber of my being. Like, please, I'll do anything. You cannot leave me and don't take my son from me. Please don't do this. Please don't. And finally, he looks at me and he caves and he says, okay, I'll stay on one condition. You go to treatment today, you get sober today. And I looked at that man and I looked at my little boy. And I knew he was going to walk out the door and I knew he was going to take my son. And I said, no. I said, no. Because here's what my brain is going to tell me. This is what my brain told me. It's like, oh, right, we can get him back tomorrow. You can figure this out tomorrow. He's going to come back. He's not really going to leave you. There's no way. You're going to get your son back, but I need a drink now. You need a drink now. A drink was more important than my marriage, than my home, and than my children. It had that much power over me. And for so many years, I drank at this. And I came in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for so many years. And I looked around and I saw you happy, joyous, and free people. And I absolutely hated your guts. Because what I believed deep down within my soul was that the freedom and redemption you had experienced here in the rooms of AA was not available to an alcoholic like me. Not after the things I did to my children, not after the things I did to my parents and my family, not after the things I did to get the next drink. There is no way the freedom that you have experienced here will be available to a scumbag piece of garbage like me. And it wasn't until I finally sat down with a woman in AA and she opened up that beautiful blue book and explained to me that for reasons yet obscure, most alcoholics have lost the power of choice when it comes to a drink. Because for so many years, I believed I chose that. I believe I chose alcohol over my children, chose them over my family. That isn't the truth. And in hearing that and seeing it in black and white, I started to get set free. Because for the first time, I knew that I wasn't some garbage, lowlife who was not worth saving, not worth redemption, not worth forgiveness. I was an alcoholic, and alcohol has that much power over me that I was beyond human aid. And that doesn't mean I am not responsible for everything I did in my act of drinking and everything I did based on self. I am absolutely responsible for all of that. And I have to spend the rest of my life doing what I can to amend these things and make them whole. But knowing that I didn't have the power changed everything for me. It just didn't happen in that moment, and it took me a lot of years to get there, because I would love to tell you losing custody of both my children was enough to get me to stop, but it wasn't. And I would love to tell you the 11 felonies that I racked up while I was in my act of drinking was enough to get me to stop, but it wasn't. All the prison sentences, all the rehabs, these weren't enough to get me to stop. My family turning their back on me, you know, losing relationships, losing jobs, losing apartments, ending up homeless, all of these things. None of these things were enough to get me to stop. And I want to clarify something here. Like, if you haven't experienced the same outside circumstances that I have, it doesn't mean anything. Like, my outside circumstances are not what make me an alcoholic. I talk about them because, A, they're part of my story, and, B, to show the power alcohol had over me, that it didn't matter what happened on the outside. There just was no human power great enough. Law enforcement wasn't great enough. My children were not great enough. The love of my family wasn't great enough. None of these things were powerful enough to separate me from alcohol. They just weren't. So I continued in my alcoholic torture for many, many years, in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I come in here, I raise my hand, I tell you about my day, I don't do any of this work, I get a sponsor in name only, I pick up a couple boyfriends, I dress up the outside. Well, I'm dying on the inside, I don't even know it, because I don't know what I suffer from. I don't know that I have a progressive and fatal illness that is going to get me. I don't know my first step that means that I'm basically screwed, and that at some day, I don't know when, I'm going to pick up a drink, and that's guaranteed. That I have lost the power of choice sober. I don't know that. And I come in and out of AA for years. And the funny thing is I think AA doesn't work. I just don't. I'm not doing it, but I think it doesn't work. The one thing that always shut me down was that God thing. You guys started talking about this God, and I wanted nothing to do with that. I'm convinced that God did these things to me, that life is happening at me. Again, another delusion I can suffer from on any given day. I take reality personally. And I certainly can't take accountability for anything I'm doing. You know, it just, you know, and this suffering just continues. And then finally, something happened on May 2nd of 2012. Because another thing that, you know, coming in and out of the rooms of AA for many, many years, I never came in with a desire to stop drinking. And thank God for these beautiful traditions and these amazing people in Alcoholics Anonymous and thank God that not a single person ever judged whether I had an honest desire to stop, because I certainly did not. What I had was an honest desire for consequences to stop. I wanted to get my kids back. I wanted to put money in my pocket. I certainly did not want to stop drinking because it was the only thing that ever made me okay. And I didn't want to stop that. But on May 2nd, 2012, something happened that had never happened before. It was about 3 or 4 in the morning, and I got in my car, and I had been on a run for I guess a little over a month, and this run was different. I had gone on these runs, a lot of them had gone well over, you know, a year, and at the end of them I usually had nothing, maybe a backpack full of clothes, no money, no nothing, nobody was talking to me, but this one, I had money in my pocket, I had a roof over my head, I had a car, and I'm on this highway, and I know I'm dying, and I can't take another second of this. And all I want to do in that moment is turn my car around and go home. And stop lying to everybody. I want to stop doing what I'm doing. I have this overwhelming and overpowering desire to turn around and stop what I'm doing, and I can't. No matter how badly I want to stop, I can't do it. And in that moment, I knew that I was drinking against my will, and this thing had me, and I started screaming out for the first time with absolute sincerity to a power I don't necessarily believe in, and I certainly don't think cares about me. And my prayer was simply this: dear God, just fucking kill me or stop me, please. Like screaming and pounding on the steering wheel, begging this power to just kill me or stop me, because I can't do this. I can't take another breath like this. And I went and I drank, and 12 hours later, I got locked up. And I got separated from alcohol for the last time, although I didn't know it at the time. And here's the insanity of this whole thing. Like, I experienced this amazing gift of desperation. And I was in that moment, I would have done anything for this to stop, for this pain to stop. But this is how insidious my ego is. 48 hours later, when I realized God didn't give me a rehab bed and some good narcotics to detox with, I realized this is not exactly what I wanted. I'm on a concrete floor of a holding cell, and I have a lot of consequences I'm about to face, and everybody's going to know what I was doing, and yada, 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 and I'm picking up the phone, and I'm calling every single person I could possibly think of who I might be able to still manipulate, and one by one, they all hang up on me. Everyone's had enough. They're like, no. And I'm left in this jail cell all over again. And with nothing. And again, I would love to tell you, I have this gift of desperation. And I have a psychic change, and everything got better. And in fact, it was the exact opposite. You separate me from the only solution I've ever had in my entire life, and it was not replaced with a spiritual solution or anything else, and I became a monster. I became 10 times worse. Everything up here in my head got so much worse. And this is what it looks like. 18 months I ended up in jail. I had 11 felonies at this point, and I got locked up on this little summary retail theft, and I'm thinking this is going to be no big deal. Like, the judge is going to just give me a slap on the wrist and, you know, send me home. And apparently the judge has had enough of me at this point and sent me to state prison. And for 18 months I was physically separated from alcohol with no solution in my life, either spiritual or chemical. And so what I do is I call my parents home on a phone account they're paying for, and I tell them what they need to do for me. This is how you're supposed to help me. This is what you're supposed to do for me. I am writing long apology letters home about how sorry I am, but maybe if you were better parents or siblings, I wouldn't be here. P.S. Send money. And that's what it looks like when you just separate me from the solution, because what my real problem is selfishness and self-centeredness. Although I don't know, I'm driven by 100 forms of, you know, self-seeking, self-pity, fear, delusion, all this other stuff. I just don't know it. And after 18 months, I get released, and my ego has completely rebuilt itself. I'm like coming out, like, I know how I'm going to run my life. I'm going to manage my life. I have a, you know, state parole officer and a 7 p.m. curfew. I am unemployed and I have no money and I'm moving to a recovery house. And I think I know how to manage my life at this point. This is how delusional I become. And I'm like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get out of here. I'm going to get back together with the ex-boyfriend I just went on my last run with. And we're going to move into a couple's recovery house together. And this is how this is going to go. And within 48 hours of me being home, every plan I had for my life was, you know, yanked away from me. And I was left with absolutely nothing. Nothing. No job, no money, no phone. Hanging out close from my niece, and my family's not talking to me. How shocking, right? And I'm crying out to God all over again. A God I don't really know if I believe in, and a God I don't think really cares about me, because what's happening is I haven't had a drink in 18 months, and I'm curled up on the floor of a recovery house bathroom in the fetal position, and I want to die. And I don't know what's wrong with me because I haven't had a drink, and I thought alcohol was my problem. And I'm crying out, like, what am I supposed to do now, God? Like, what if I can't live like this? If this is what sobriety looks like, I just want to die. So I have this moment of clarity where, like, I know that if I go out that door again and start drinking again, I'm dead. It's over. So I just am begging God, like, what do I do now? Please show me what I'm supposed to do. And I was directed by a power greater than myself, which at the time was the recovery house manager, up the steps of my old home group, the Greater Northeast Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's where things started to happen. Because for the first time, I saw God. I saw God in the eyes of a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. This God I've been looking for, you know, my whole life, this connection and this power. I've been looking, you know, out in the sky, like Sky Daddy stuff and all this in churches and everywhere. I see God sitting in front of me in the eyes of these sober members of AA. And the reason I knew this was a power that was so much bigger is because these were people I drank with, I got high with. These people I knew were just as messed up as me. And these people were walking around the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they were walking around with that book, that blue book, and they were talking about God and the 12 steps, and they were lit up. They were sober. Their entire deportment shouted. They had an answer. And I knew they didn't do that. I knew they were just like me. And I really still wasn't sold, because I'm still stuck in this thought, like, you know what? This redemption just isn't available for me, but I'm out of ideas and I don't know what else to do, so I'll do whatever you tell me to do. And I asked a woman to help me, and she started taking me through the 12 steps, and honestly, I didn't know what any of the words meant. Everything was uncomfortable. My first third step experience, where I make the most important decision I've ever made in my entire life, I missed that moment because I was so busy thinking about myself and feeling uncomfortable, because I'm in the floor of a recovery house kneeling, holding her hand, and I'm thinking everyone's looking at me. So I don't know what words I'm saying, these beautiful words and this decision I'm making. But what happens is I get up from that prayer and I start writing. And you know, it really lays it out beautifully in the big book when you turn that page over from our third step prayer, and it says, although this decision is a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of what was blocking us. And I got immediately into action and I started writing this inventory. And my sponsor, she was brilliant because she knew how I showed up. She knew the only thing I had was in me were those first two columns. So she told me, just write a list, make four columns, just write out two. Write who you're angry at and why. And I just went to town. Here's 27 pages. Boom. You and what you did to me is how I show up to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have stories to tell you. And as I sat there going through this work with this woman, and as we moved our way to those, you know, the third and fourth column, something started to happen that had never happened to me before. This shift in perception where I saw the truth for the first time in my entire life. And it certainly wasn't pretty. For instance, my mother, she had a page entirely to herself. I don't know if anybody else has a mom who made them an alcoholic, but I did. At least that's what I was convinced of. And as I get to that fourth column where we, you know, are prepared to look at this from an entirely different angle and we resolutely, you know, look at our own mistakes, where was I selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and afraid? And I start to look at how, you know, not only how horrible I've been to this woman for 20 plus years or longer, but what I see out of this conversation that I have with my sponsor at the time was that I took this one decision that my mother made when I was 15 years old, and I allowed it to blind me to every beautiful thing that woman did for me every day since. Every time she showed up in rehab or detox with a fresh set of clothes, every time she paid my bail or invited me to Thanksgiving dinner where nobody wanted me. That's who my mother really is, and I just can't see that. That's what my resentment does. It blinds me to the truth, it blinds me to you, and it blinds me to God, and I can't connect with anything with these things in my way. That's the purpose of this, to face and be rid of what was blocking me. See, here's the funny thing. I'm running around looking for this power out here, all over here. The power's here. The power was deep within me, deep, that fundamental idea of God that is deep down within every man, woman, and child. It's there already. I just had all this stuff piled away in front of it. And it was slowly, as I started to do this work, I started to experience that power from within, the power that you guys were talking about. And it wasn't comfortable. Like, you know, I know some people who walk out of their inventory, their first inventory, and they do experience these promises. Like, oh, I can look the world in the eye and feel the nearness of my creator. That's not what I felt. At least not that first time. I've done multiple inventories since because, you know, I don't do alcohol. I don't do AA great. Let's put it that way. I've messed up a lot. But that first one, I'm telling you, I felt worse. Because I look on this paper and I see who I am and I don't want to be that person anymore. This is not who I want to be. And I'm glad that's how I felt because it moved me with purpose and momentum through the rest of these steps. That's not who I wanted to be. I mean, listen, 6 and 7 were super easy coming in because like I'm not clinging to anything. Every single defect of character is causing me horrific consequences. I don't want this. Take it. It's all, the bar's really low, by the way. I'm a liar, a cheat, a thief. Like, sure, take everything. Fast forward to 10 years sober. Not so much. I like gossiping. I like doing that. You know, it's just different stuff and it gets a lot harder. Cause I look around this beautiful life that I have today and I think I did that. And I think I still need to manage things and I become agnostic and those defects of character. They're just my fear coming out thinking I need to control this situation. And it gets a lot harder and I have to do a lot more work, but coming in that gift of desperation, those steps were just like, okay, just like, you know, God, remove this so I can go out in the world and attempt to sweep away the debris that is accumulated out of my efforts to live on self-will and run the show myself. It doesn't even say anything about alcohol because I can cause just as much harm sober. And that was evident by my inventory at 8 years sober in the middle of COVID where I owed 26 amends. And these were not like, oh, I'm sorry, I cut you off in traffic. These were big ones because the problem never had anything to do with alcohol. It was always how I behaved, how I treated you, how I tried to run the show, how I tried to manage everything around me. But I will tell you, during that first round of amends was where I really started to feel that power from within. When I sought out these people that I had harmed, the people I hurt more than anybody else in the world, and I sat in front of them and I didn't say, I'm sorry. I said, I was wrong. I this is what I did to you. And I gave them an opportunity to tell me how I made them feel. And then I asked them what I need to do to make it right. And then I followed that up with direct action. And then I start to experience these promises. These extravagant promises. That's probably one of the only things I'm going to argue with you about the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. To me, they're the most extravagant promises I could possibly imagine because I didn't know a life without fear. And you're telling me that I'm going to know this new freedom and new happiness, that I won't regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. And I will tell you what happened. When by the time I got to step 12 and I sat down with another woman, I realized what God had done for me, that he took all those shameful and horrible, disgusting things that I thought I would never be redeemed for and never be forgiven for, and he transformed them and he made them my most useful tools in Alcoholics Anonymous. So when a woman comes to me and she tells me I couldn't stop drinking during my pregnancy and I abandoned my children and I did this to get a drink, instead of judging her, looking down on her, I can look at her and I say, no, me too. I did that too. And I had no idea that, you know, I come in the rooms of AA and I come here to stop drinking and that's it. I come here to stop going to prison and that's it. And I, you know, I you guys are talking about a life beyond my wildest dreams and I don't know what that means. In fact, coming in, I think a life beyond my wildest dreams is supposed to be like a six-figure income and a really hot guy and like that's it. And I don't have either of those things. What I've come to realize about this life beyond my wildest dreams, it's about being present in the life that I have and showing up for that and being able, the gift of being able to be of maximum service to God and the people around me. And this is an absolute gift. And it doesn't always feel like a gift. When I was coming up on 4 years sober, I got a phone call from my mother and who told me that my oldest sister Amy was dead. And in that moment, I intuitively knew how to handle a situation that would have baffled me. I intuitively knew that it was time to show up for my mother and make this about her and my father who were burying their child and my sister's children who were burying their mother, that this wasn't about me. And God gives me this beautiful gift where I get to stand next to my mother, like the timing, God's timing, like where I was put in this position to be standing next to my mother where she sees her daughter in the casket for the first time. And I got to be there to comfort my mother and make it about her and hold her in her agony and her pain. And I didn't run from that and I didn't hide from that. And this was the woman I had my greatest resentment towards. And I get to be present in that moment to do that. And not only that, I got the last year and a half of my sister's life, and we had the best friendship we had ever had. My sister was spiritually sick in a very similar way. She was severely anorexic, and that was the disease that killed her. And she had nobody in this world that she trusted other than me, because my story held depth and weight, and you guys taught me how to share that with her. And for the last year and a half of her life, she wasn't as alone. And I get to carry that with me for the rest of my life. You know, and, you know, I remember when I made an amends to my mom, when, you know, I had asked my mom, you know, what can I do to make this right after I admitted all my wrongs? And my mother said to me, I need you to be a living example of recovery to your little brother. And, I'll tell you, you know, I'm always looking for, you know, my dad was the easy one and he was the, you know, just keep doing what you're doing. But that one was tough, being a living example of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous to my brother. And 5 weeks ago, my brother died of a fentanyl overdose. And we had an argument before he died. A month before he died, we were on the phone and I don't even remember what the argument was about, but it was stupid. And he said something to me and I said something to him and, he said something back and he said, okay, well, why don't you just tell me how you really feel? And my ego said, okay, like, let's go. And of course I do it in a calm, controlled AA, moral, spiritual hilltop way. And, I was convinced I was right to say this. Well, I think it's time for you to start taking accountability for your life, and it's time to stop blaming mommy and daddy for your problems. And he screamed at me and he said, I will never speak to you again. And he wasn't lying. And after I got off the phone, I had an inkling that maybe I feel like I was right, but maybe not. So maybe I should call my sponsor, and I call my sponsor, and it's an hour and a half long 10 step about this. And this is why 10 and 11, by the way, are vital. Vital steps for me. I 10-step multiple times a day. And I call my sponsor and by the end of this conversation, you know, we get to the truth, which is basically this is my ego and his ego. And like the truth is we love each other dearly. And the truth is I needed to clean it up. And she told me that and she said, you need to clean this up because it says properly, right? when we were wrong, we promptly admitted it. And of course, I don't want to do that because I'm sort of convinced, well, you know, what I said was the truth. But she said, nope, he didn't deserve that. He didn't ask for that. So you're going to clean it up. And so if he doesn't unblock you in 3 days, I want you to write him a note. And so for 3 straight days, I texted him the same thing, and he still had me blocked. He still had me blocked. And after, you know, the third day, I wrote him a note, and I texted his girlfriend, and I asked for the address, and I wrote a note on the paper this big, because I wouldn't allow my ego any more space on the paper to write anything other than what I needed to say. And all I said was, "Dear Benjamin, I was wrong to speak to you that way. You didn't deserve that. I love you very much. Love, Sarah." And after he died, his girlfriend told me, he had read the note. He said, I'm going to keep her blocked for a few more weeks and make her sweat it out. She said, why? And he said, because I can. And I'm like, that's just who he was. And that was the relationship we had. But thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous, and thank God for that 10th step. Because the day my brother died on the floor of that bathroom, he knew his sister loved him. And here's the truth. Like, you know, sometimes God's will is really, really painful, because my will for my brother was that he had the experience that I have. My will for my brother was that he sit here in this room, but my brother was suffering horribly, and I don't know what kind of pain he was. And maybe the pain was just so great that God had to take him home. I don't know that. But I do know this, that I get to be present in this, and I got to show up, and I got to carry my brother in a little box on the way to his funeral, and I got to eulogize him, and I got to play, you know, pick out the playlist for him, and I got to honor my brother's life. And when I asked my mother a couple weeks ago, when I said to her, "Do you remember what I asked you in that amends?" And I said, "Do you remember when you asked me to be a living example to Benjamin? Do you think I failed?" And I didn't know my dad was on the call as well, and they both yelled out emphatically, "No, no." In fact, my dad said, it's the exact opposite. My dad said everybody was shocked that he didn't get it after witnessing the transformation you experienced. So I know that I did everything I could in my power to help my brother. It's just, you know, our lives have to bear witness to those who it could be helped, and maybe the only way my brother could be helped is not be here anymore. But that doesn't mean my life can't bear witness, because I will tell you this, no matter how much pain I'm in, no matter, I've woken up every day with a broken heart for the past 5 weeks, and I miss my brother every second of every day, but my life still bears witness, because Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the ability to walk through this with dignity and grace, walk through this not once thinking about a drink and continuing to show up for other people. To be present in this, to not run from this, to not hide from this. This is a life beyond my wildest dreams. I ran from everything. And I do have joy in my life. I don't want to get up here tonight and tell you it all sucks. It is painful. None of us are going to be able to avoid this stuff, by the way. Everybody's going to lose somebody we love. Everybody's going to lose a job or a relationship or a loved one. This is happening. You know, I used to come in AA, and people were like, "Well, you know, life shows up." Bullshit. Life's here. We finally show up and are present in this thing, and that's this gift that we get. And when I'm in this, and when I'm practicing these principles, these perfect principles, as imperfectly as I practice them, I get to experience this life. And play these roles that God assigns me, which means I get to be a daughter today. I get to be a sister today. I get to be an employee today. That part's insane. I'm an 11-time felon, and I'm a paralegal in a corporate law firm today. Like, that this kind of stuff is not anything I envisioned for my life coming in here. I didn't even think it was possible. You know, I was a 10th grade dropout coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. Now I have a bachelor's degree, and I'm going into an MBA program. Like, I have my own house and my own car and a great credit score because you guys taught me how to pay money back that I owed. Like, I get to live a productive member. I'm a productive member of the community. I am, you know, a trusted employee. I'm a trusted friend. I get to sponsor women. You know, I get to watch their lives be transformed by this work. I get to see them get their children back. You know, I get to see them get their families back. I get to see them walk through the same pain and struggles that I've walked through sober and with grace. I get to witness miracles every single day, as long as I'm awake to them, as long as I'm, you know, continuing to perfect and enlarge my spiritual life through, you know, these steps, especially 10 and 11, continuing to seek God. I get to be a mother today. Listen, my daughter is my best friend in the entire world. And by all rights, my daughter should hate my guts, and she doesn't. And that's a testimony to Alcoholics Anonymous and the work we do here. You guys taught me how to be a mother. You gave me my child back. Because before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, all I knew how to do was have babies, and I never did it for any good motive. But now you guys teach me how to show up and love my daughter for who she is and, you know, not try to fix her, not try to change her. And because of that, she's closer to me than the man who raised her. And that's not because he's a bad person. It's just because, like, I just am present with her. And this is probably one of the greatest gifts I've ever been given, to like watch her graduate law school and travel around the country with her and run marathons with her, stuff I never would have imagined in a million years. This is the joy Alcoholics Anonymous gives me. And like the thing about it is the joy I experience from this program really has nothing to do with the stuff that I have. It has to do with this deep joy that I experience from living this thing called life, from experiencing that connection that I was seeking my entire life. That I was looking to connect with something greater than myself from the time I was a little girl, and I found that here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I found God here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't find God in church. I didn't find God out there. I didn't find God in a man. I found God here in Alcoholics Anonymous and in that book. And what happened when I opened that book and I took the direction as it's outlined in the book, I didn't have to do much to seek God. I experienced God. I experienced God through taking these actions. And again, like, not everything is perfect. Like, I have a son I haven't seen in 16 years now. I lost custody of my son when he was 6 years old. And he wants nothing to do with me. Nothing. His father and his stepmother, the woman who raised him, they want nothing to do with me. And I've made attempts. When I first went through my steps, I made an attempt. I wrote a letter and they didn't respond. And I've made multiple attempts to make this right. They don't want anything to do with me. I still, every single month, I write a card and I send it to my son and I write a note and I send cash and I don't get anything in response and I don't expect anything. I remember coming up on a few years sober, I don't even remember specifically, but I was really struggling with this situation because my head's telling me, well, you've got like whatever, 3 or 4 years sober. Like, you know, why isn't he talking to you? Why haven't they forgiven you? Like that whole idea of the, you know, the man who comes out of the cellar, Amy Grant, the wind stopped blowing. Like I ripped through this boy's life. It is a miracle he survived having me as a mother. I'm not even like exaggerating when I said that. And, I was really struggling at this time and well-meaning people in and out of the rooms of AA were telling me, all right, well, you know what? You need to get a lawyer. You need to do this. You never fully lost rights. And, you know, that's what I wanted to do. And I'll tell you what I still want to do. I know where my boy lives and not too far from here, actually. And, what I want to do on any given day is I want to drive to that front door and I want to bang on that door and I want to throw my arms around him and I want to tell him I love him and how sorry I am and how much I miss him. But I don't get to do what I want to do anymore. So instead of doing what I wanted to do and what people were telling me to do, I did what the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says to do, and I asked God for an intuitive thought or decision, direction, inspiration. And I asked and I begged and I pleaded. I have to be honest, I'm very bad at that other part that says we relax and take it easy. I've never been good at that. But I begged and I fought with God. I'm like, please, please just show me. Show me what to do. At this point, I hadn't seen my son in a decade. I didn't even know what he looked like. And I'm begging like, God, please show me what I'm supposed to do here. Please help me. And then one night I typed my son's name into Instagram and there he was. I saw his face for the first time in a decade. And my son is beautiful and loved and happy. And there was a peace that came into my heart, you know, that peace that passes all understanding. That peace in knowing that the restoration of this relationship will happen on God's time and not mine. And what's happened with more work and digging deeper and peeling away more layers and is this deeper knowing and seeking God is this deeper knowing that the restoration of this relationship may never look the way I want it to. But God will use it for something bigger. I just can't see that yet. And for me, that's what faith looks like. And it's not perfect. And I mess this up like all the time. All the time. I will never be perfect at this. I don't ever want to be perfect at this because I think the day I'm perfect at it, I cease to be useful. But I will tell you what's happened is that I come into Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm convinced that the outside has to look a certain way for me to be okay inside. In fact, I'm sold on that idea that I can't get and stay sober, you know, unless I have the relationship, or I can't get and stay sober if somebody I love dies. I can't get and stay sober if I don't get my children back. I believe that coming in here. But then the experience I've had in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous say otherwise. It actually says, you know, we have to burn the idea into the consciousness of every person that we can get well regardless of anyone. All we have to do is trust God and clean house, provided we trust God and clean house. And that has been my experience. When my house is clean and I rely on a power greater than myself, I become well. And when I'm well in here, the drink becomes irrelevant. I don't need it anymore. Yes, I will never be perfect, and I can still be free. I am no less free than a person who has all their family members above ground or all their family members willing to talk to them. I am no less free because I'm willing to do this work. And I'm really not special or unique. I'm just an alcoholic, just like everybody else here in this room. The same freedom that I've experienced, the same ability to walk through all this pain and heartache without the thought of a drink, is available to every single one of us. The ability to get well regardless of anything is available to every single person in this room. All we have to do is work for it. Anyway, that's all I have. Thanks.